Hi guys, this is Season 1, Episode 2 of The Meridian, and we are coming to you from Lund Observatory in southern Sweden on October 1st, 2021. We gear up to celebrate Culture Night this weekend. Crossing our local Meridian in this episode, we have Josephine Martell, who studies impact craters on Earth and prepares for investigating samples on Mars. In each episode, we will also take a closer look at an astronomical object we find interesting. This week, we will be taking a closer look at the planet named Dimidium. More about that later.
The Meridian.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. I'm actually super excited about the Culture Night that's happening this week. But before talking about that, I want to tell you about the EAU 100 Hours. Have you heard about it?
I have not, Liz. But what's it about?
So EAU is the International Astronomical Union.
Okay.
And it was sort of huge during the International Year of Astronomy in 2009.
Okay.
They sort of started this event that lasts for 100 hours of only doing astronomy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And this year, we're actually a part of that event by having this podcast.
Oh, that's so cool. Are we the only Swedish people to apply for this?
I think so, actually. But, you know, we're not just anyone, right?
No, we're very important people.
Yeah.
But what else have we got going on then?
Yeah, so Culture Night is happening tomorrow, and partly the planetarium will be open where I work.
Okay.
So it's part of this sort of exhibition with artificial intelligence, and actually Anna has produced this show about the ESS.
Yeah.
So that's going to happen. So if you want to come, you have to sort of pre-book a ticket, but it's for free and you can do it on the webpage on Vattenhallen.
Cool. Yeah. And I heard also that Daniel, who works at our office, is going to be helping out with something called the laser show.
Yeah, he's part of the physics and laser show. I actually used to be that too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. But it's sort of a classic happening at Culture Night in Physicum. So it's a physics and laser show. It's super cool. Same thing there. I think you have to pre-book a ticket, but it's free. And
so elevator pitch, if you're going to sell me the laser show,
yeah,
what would you say?
Okay, so it's like physics experiments done in a very fun, comedic way, but, you know, still science. And then the laser show is just this, like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of just like 1,000 lasers going everywhere and coordinated with this, you know, awesome movie music.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. And that's not the only person who's performing tonight that works at astronomy. We also have Eric.
Right, yeah, and I think I saw him in the corridor, so maybe we should just
Eric, you want to, you want to come and join the post? Yeah.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
So I hear you're performing during Culture Night. What exactly are you doing?
Oh, yeah, right. So when I'm not doing astronomy, I'm a musician and play in a band called Leading Edge.
Okay.
We're playing music that is like this indie folk, post-folk kind of style.
Nice. Okay. And you guys are on Spotify?
We are on Spotify, and we have a few songs there. We also have a Facebook page, of course, that you can check out if you want more information about what we do.
Yeah. And so when are you actually playing?
So we're playing at 11 in the evening.
Yep.
We're playing at the Stadstheater, or the City Theater.
Cool.
Downtown.
Yep. And do you need a ticket or anything like that to come and see?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, how long have you been playing music for?
I've been playing for 10, 12 years, but with the band I started in 2015.
Nice. And you play the guitar, are you lead singer?
So I'm the drummer. I'm the guy hiding in the back.
All right. Yeah. But, you know, they're essential and they're also probably the coolest people in the band. So
thank you.
Rebecca, what is on your Twitter feed right now?
All right. So, okay. Is this like a telescope tournament that's been going on for, well, it was for like a month or so, actually.
No. And I missed it?
Yeah, I guess you missed it.
Okay.
It was quite interesting. And it's really, you know, I guess astronomers are not really sport geeks in general. But really, this sort of brought us all together.
Yeah.
So this guy named Ori Fox, I guess. I don't really know who it is. He started this telescope tournament where you got to vote for various telescopes. So he sort of started off with a battle between the Hubble and Fuse. And
Fuse, okay.
Hubble won.
Yep.
And then it was TESS and Kepler. That was a hard one.
Yeah, right. Exoplanets. That probably would have been one of the ones I picked.
Yeah, which one would you have picked?
I'd probably go with Kepler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kepler actually won, and I think I voted Kepler. But then, you know, Hubble and Kepler
had
a battle of...
And what happened to Kepler?
Yeah, well, it was struck down by Hubble.
Of course,
so this has been, like, following us on Twitter for, a couple of weeks. And actually, it was the final battle off between NASA/ESA Hubble and the ESA telescope Gaia.
Oh, wow. Okay, yes. I can imagine that got a bit tense.
Really? So that's sort of what I've been looking at now, like the comments from sort of American-based astronomers and European-based astronomers has been like arguing for these various telescopes, but actually Gaia won.
Okay. And did you vote for Gaia?
Yeah, of course. I think I would sort of be a bad Lund Observatory astronomer if I didn't vote for Gaia.
Okay, so in the flag of Europe to, you know.
But also, I've been working with Gaia, and Gaia is an amazing telescope. We have Paul coming in the last episode to actually talk about Gaia, I hope. So, that really happened. But yeah, so kudos to this Ori Fox guy, who I don't really know who it is, but he says he works on the James Webb Space Telescope.
So. Oh, that's launching soon, isn't it? That's like 18th of December?
Yes, we finally got a date, you know, all fingers and toes crossed here. But yeah, it's got a date for launching in, you say, middle of December, so right before Christmas. And I guess a lot of us will be nervous about that, right? Mm.
Do you think it's going to actually launch, or do you think we're going to...
Oh, yeah, I guess there could be, like, bad weather or so, but I think it will launch. But also, this is sort of, I guess, an American-European thing. I really hope that at least the rocket, which is an Ariane 5 rocket, stays intact, because otherwise we might get shit for it.
Well, that was, exactly. I hope it goes up there, too. We've been waiting for this so long. Obviously, it's not it wasn't part of the tournament either, so...
Exactly.
You know, it might have been a different story if we had James Webb against ESA as, you know, Gaia satellite at that point. Would you have...
I don't think so.
You still would have voted for Gaia?
Yeah, of course I would have voted for Gaia. I'm a sucker for Gaia. It's an amazing telescope. It's been doing beautiful science and, ESA.
Yeah. Look, I probably would have voted for Gaia too. No offense to any of you Hubble fans out there. So it's just a...
Yeah, I guess although James Webb will actually have like some Swedish instruments on it, or like Swedish collaborating instruments. But
so there you go. It might have shifted the balance a little bit.
Yeah, perhaps. We'll have to ask this guy to make another tournament, I guess, in a couple of years or so.
I think I could be a fan of telescope tournaments, you know.
I'll let you know if I see anyone.
Maybe even me put in the Olympics at some point. Who knows?
And now I'd like to welcome to the mic Josephine Martel, a researcher visiting us from the Department of Geology here at Lund University. Welcome, Josephine.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited on being a guest at the Astronomy podcast.
Yeah, and you know, likewise, we're super excited to have a geology researcher here. So yeah, could you sort of tell us a little about yourself and why are you studying geology?
Yeah, so I'm in the research in the field of planetary geology, but this is, of course, really interdisciplinary. So in order to understand the formation of the planets and our solar system, you need researchers from astronomy, physics, chemistry, and also biology. And why I study geology, it's really a coincidence, I would say. So geology isn't its own subject here in Sweden. So when I wasn't really sure what it was, to be honest. I just followed a friend to her class. And I thought, well, why not? And then the first semester we learned about volcanoes and mass extinctions and climate change. And it was just like all of these really exciting topics. And then we also had a guest lecture on planetary geology. And I think that was when it kind of fell into place for me, because I've always been really interested in space and I took some astronomy classes and now I got to like combine it.
Oh, that's so cool. So why did you sort of went with geology and not astronomy then? As an astronomer, I'm sort of like, why did you pick the one?
I mean, I don't know, actually. It just happened. And I thought, like, I took, like, one class, and then I thought, well, this is so interesting. Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested also in Earth and why it looks the way it does. And, and I mean, Earth is also a planet. And right. Now, as in astrogeology or planetary geology, you put Earth into a larger context. Mm-hmm. So you apply what you know about Earth, so volcanoes and all the features you see, but then you turn to the extraterrestrial objects and you use the knowledge you have about Earth and apply that to those objects.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, because Earth we can sort of study in detail and then we can apply that to other planets.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But there are also features on Earth. So for example, impact craters, that's the dominant geological features on the rocky planets in our solar system. But on Earth, we have very few impact craters. Mm. So if you would just turn to the moon, for example, you see that it's full of craters. And also if you would see an image of Mars, you would also see that it's full of craters. But on Earth, we have discovered around 200
in total.
Wow. And those are not even like craters. So there is one crater in US, which is called Meteor Crater. Wow. It's a very suitable name because it's really a meteor crater.
Yeah.
But that one, you really see it as like a feature in the desert. But most impact structures, we would say, on Earth, they are, I mean, maybe it's a lake that is like a depression. And then you would look for like at the rocks and then you would find tracers that tells you that this lake or this depression was formed by a meteorite impact, but it's not obvious in the landscape in the same way.
Oh, that's so cool. So you could sort of just be, you know, like out walking, hiking in the forest, and you could be sort of walking in a previous meteor crater.
I mean, I guess you could. I mean, we tend to go for maybe if there's some kind of geological features that stands out. So let's say a circular lake, for example. Right. But then there are many processes on Earth that can create circular features. So you can also, I think Meteor Crater, for example, first they thought it was the result of a volcanic eruption.
Right.
But then there was some clever person that started to look at the rocks. And that was the same for the moon. They thought that they were like remnants from volcanic activity. Mm-hmm. But then when they brought back the Apollo samples, they could see that, okay, these rocks have been subjected to super high pressures and temperatures, and that only happens when you have these meteorite impacts.
Right. Yeah, because you sort of did this as a part of your PhD, right? You looked at this lake in Småland.
Yes.
That you actually sort of confirmed was a meteor crater, right?
Yeah, so I would say in the community we already know that it was the result of a meteorite impact, because they found these high pressure minerals, so minerals that you, and also like features in minerals that you only get when you have these super high pressures during a very short period of time. But that lake has been a bit controversial, I would say. Like if you go there, it's called Mian. Mm-hmm. You would see on all the signs, it says that it could be the result of a volcano, a volcanic eruption, which is not true. But for some reason, they just keep the signs. And I don't know, maybe it keeps some kind of, it becomes more mystical, maybe, right, that there is something we need to solve. But I mean, it's really, what we found was also traces of one of these high pressure minerals that you only get from meteorite impact. So I kind of wanted to, I don't know, I think it's good when the public knows a little bit of what we are doing at the department. And of course, it's really difficult if you just see this sign and you don't know anything about like high pressure minerals. How can you know if it's the result of a volcano or a meteorite crater? So
so you're like myself and Nick, a PhD student, so I'm curious, what is your PhD project about, and are you working on any exciting projects right now?
So first of all, since I'm a planetary geologist, I study planetary materials. So I look at meteorites, but also so-called impactites.
Mm-hmm.
And an impactite is basically a rock that have been created or modified during an impact. So you can find that on all planets, but I look at terrestrial impactites.
Right.
So what is happening is that if a meteor hits the surface of a planet, in high enough speed and form a crater, the energy from this meteor is transferred to the rocks so that they can melt and deform in various ways. And the meteor itself gets vaporized. And in rare cases, pieces and traces of the meteorite can be preserved within these impactites.
Oh.
So physical pieces is really rare, but you can find certain elements that mm-hmm. are common in meteorites. For example, iridium.
Right, these like heavy elements.
Yeah, and they are not so common on the surface of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So you can look for anomalies in, for example, iridium. And this is how they discovered this dinosaur killer layer on Earth.
Right.
There is this clay layer that you can find on several places on Earth that formed when this meteorite hit the Earth around 66 million years ago. And in this clay, you have this iridium anomaly
mm-hmm.
That comes from the impacting asteroid.
Oh, that's cool. Is it just iridium or is it other heavy elements as well?
You can get other platinum group elements as well.
Right.
But usually you tend to like go for the iridium.
Oh, that's so cool.
So, So I look at that. But also meteorites are really interesting, of course. They're often referred to as like time capsules from the early solar system. I guess you also know a lot about meteorites, but...
You know some, but I would say here you're really the expert.
Yeah, so I mean they can give us a lot of information about like past geological activity on other planetary bodies, and we have meteorites from Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only like physical material we have right now. So the Perseverance mission, yes. which is now on Mars, they are drilling for samples that will. The plan is to return them back to Earth. But right now we only have the meteorites from Mars.
That's so cool. But anyway, do you have one of those?
Yes, I do.
Ah!
So I am studying one of those right now. So I don't know if you know about the European Spallation Source.
Yeah, we actually have a person from the ESS coming here speaking in a couple of weeks. So
that sounds super exciting. I want to listen to that episode.
Yeah, of course.
So they have this neutron source. Mm-hmm. And what I do is at the moment, I look at both my impactites and my meteorites. And I try to create these 3D models of mm-hmm. them. So I use both X-ray tomography and neutron tomography. And it's kind of similar to what you would do in the hospital. So right. if you want to see if you have a fracture mm-hmm. in your arm, you would scan your arm, of course,
yeah, of
and
course.
Then you would see the bone, but the flesh around it will be transparent.
Yeah.
Which is great if you're looking for a fracture.
Mm.
And that's because, different densities and different elements attenuate in a different way. So they will pop up on an image. And the heavier they are in the periodic system, or the periodic table, the more they will pop up on your image. So, for example, hydrogen does not show up if you scan your rock, or your arm, with X-rays.
Mm.
So if you're interested in biological material, or in this case, so a rock is obviously not made up by the same things as a body,
no.
a human body. So if you have your rock and you're interested in clay minerals, for example, something that contains a lot of hydrogen, then X-rays are not the best method to use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you can use neutrons instead, because they interact differently with matter. So to just keep it simple, I use different methods. So it's my PhD is rather method-based.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this can also be... So if you have a really rare meteorite, if you have a Martian meteorite, you wouldn't want to crush it the first
no,
thing you
exactly.
do. Because they're valuable. And all samples from sample return missions, you want to preserve them as pristine as possible.
And I guess like this is just a guess from me, but I guess sort of the shape of the rock could say tell you something as well, perhaps?
Absolutely. Yeah, so the three-dimensional shape. Mm. So even if you cut your sample and study that in the microscope, this thin section you can cut out, you would still only get a 2D view of the sample. So if you have fractures extending through the rock, you want to see like what it looks like inside. So it's really good to have these 3D models.
Right.
So yeah, that's it. Now ESS is not up and running.
No, of course. It's a couple of years left, right?
Yeah, so we have to go to other neutron sources. But I mean, hopefully at ESS they can also do these experiments. Mm.
Okay. So you talk about sample return missions, but your meteor is not from one of those, right?
No, exactly. So this is a meteorite from Mars that was ejected from Mars. So it was a rock laying calmly and nicely on Mars, but then there was an impact and this material was ejected up in space. And at some point it fell down on Earth. And the one that I look at fell down on Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And then a scientist picks it up and then we can study it. So that's the difference. So we haven't returned any samples ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Has that been, so that hasn't been done at all yet?
No. So that's one of the goals of this mission right now, that they are drilling for samples on specific places that they have determined are extra interesting. And then they will bring those drill cores back.
Oh, wow. I think that's so cool that actually sort of a rock has been ejected out from the surface of Mars and then landed here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that we can find them. That's cool. That's great. But then also, of course, there are limitations to that. So one problem is that if it falls down on Antarctica and lies there for a long time, it will become contaminated. So that's also why it's so nice with these pristine samples that we will get from the sample returns, because they have not been altered in any way.
But I guess Antarctica is still like a pretty cold place, right? It's not much living stuff there.
Yeah, and that's usually, I mean, many meteorites, you find them on Antarctica and in deserts because it's easier to look for them there.
So does that as well happen sort of the other way around? Do we have rocks from the Earth being like on Mars?
That's an excellent question. I don't know if there are any Earth rocks on Mars, but there are on Moon, for example. So there have been rocks that were blasted off Earth at some point and then fell down on the Moon.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned that there are like robots right now on Mars sort of drilling to get these samples. What are like the instruments on Mars right now and what are they sort of looking at?
There are so many instruments on this rover, but for example, there is the MastCam that takes these nice footage, and a lot of geologists are looking at those footage because it can give us an idea of the landscape, and we want to interpret like how did it form. So
right, so you can still get a lot of info without actually getting samples back to Earth.
Absolutely. So for example, if you see sedimentary deposits, that can give you a hint of, did we have water in this place?
No, because I've seen from pictures of Mars that it sort of looks like it's been these like streams or floodbeds.
Yeah.
Like structures. So.
Yeah, and that is because we can compare it to what we see on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Ah, of course. Yeah, that's cool. So what would you like to achieve or like find out with your research? Like, what's your dream discovery?
I mean, everything is really a group effort. So,
yeah, that's true.
So I don't have like a perfect answer to that, but I hope that the research that we do can be, for example, helpful when you get these samples back from Mars and you want to study them without contaminating them. So as soon as you bring them out of the containers, the sample containers, there is a risk of contamination. So if you're interested in, I guess, the most difficult thing is they want to find these biosignatures on Mars. And as soon as you expose them to anything on Earth, there will be a risk of contamination. So the less destructive things you do in the beginning, the better. So I hope that the neutron X-ray tomography thing that we're doing could be helpful in that. And I mean, I'm really excited about the life in universe thing.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I think it would be amazing if they could detect any biosignatures.
Yeah, and I guess as you say, your work here to create this method is really a step towards perhaps actually be able to discover life or life signs on a rock or something.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's a little piece of the puzzle. Yeah. Then of course you have people from different disciplines, and biologists, for example, are extremely important. I don't know that much about biology, to be honest. So, I mean, they will have to do their thing. But yeah. I think it's really a group effort when it comes to that. And yeah, like the missions right now, they are kind of focused on finding biosignatures.
Right.
But first we need to like study the rocks we have and see like what methods can we use and how can we apply these methods on extraterrestrial samples.
I think this is really cool. And you sort of touched upon it in the beginning, like how you went then to this class and then you sort of discovered geology in a way. Because as you said, we don't really do geology much here in Sweden. Like I remember I didn't have much of it in school. It was sort of just like a couple of hours or something. I haven't really get in touch with geology that much. So what really draws you to this specific area of research?
I mean, first of all, geology is really a broad field. So as a geologist, you can work with, I don't know, volcanoes, glaciers, climate reconstructions, the physics and the chemistry of Earth and natural resources. So I mean it's basically everything in nature. So it's really, really a broad field. And I think everyone could actually find something that they're interested in. Like why does the landscape look the way it does? But space have always been to me like the most fascinating field. When I was little, I was dreaming about being an astronomer. So I mean, now I'm also able to like look at physical material, which is really nice. You can also use, of course, orbital data and things like that. But it's also great to be able to like hold in your hand physical material. And I don't know, it's easy to become a bit philosophical also when it comes to geology and I guess everything you do as well. Like, where do we come from? Why? Yeah. How did the solar system form? And then you have these massive processes, like an impact event, which is super violent. And then you have the rock in your hand and you look at the super tiny minerals and you can still see traces of these enormous events. And then we have these enormous time scales as well.
Yeah, right.
So billions of years or millions of years. I mean, you get a bit confused when you're thinking about it, but but it's also... also fascinating.
No, but I guess like geology and astronomy really share something in common. They're having these huge time scales that we're like, oh, but you know, a couple of million years ago, that's not that far away or long away. And that's really how we think. And we have that together, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I actually looked it up and most craters on Mercury, the planet, are actually named after like famous writers and artists and composers. And two of them are named after Swedes. One after August Strindberg and also one after Ulrika Pach, apparently a Swedish painter. So I was sort of curious, do you have like a favorite impact crater in the solar system and or which sort of planet or moon is it on?
So I've been thinking about this because I guess as an impact researcher you should have a favorite. And I guess there's so many that would be interesting to study scientifically, but I think I would go with more of a mainstream answer and choose one on the moon. So there is this one, the Tycho crater, which is a very prominent crater. If you look up to the sky in the night, you will see it. It has these bright rays going from the center. And it's quite a young crater. So now we have the time scales again, but it's 108 million years old. That's really young.
How do you know that it's that age?
So they have been dating samples from the moon and from this specific crater that they have been analyzing. So it has been studied already. But I think that one, first of all, is really beautiful. And it's also one of the, I don't know, like one of the only geological phenomena that you can see everywhere on Earth. And like, I think people during all times have also looked upon it and been thinking. I mean, it's inspired, you said fiction before. It has inspired a lot of fiction and people from other fields. And you don't have to travel far like Grand Canyon to see something amazing. No. You can only look up and you would notice this crater. Right. So I think I would go for the Tycho crater.
Right, so I guess it's named after Tycho Brahe.
Yeah, maybe say Tycho.
Tycho. Ah, okay. No, man, I know which one you mean. It's like the super bright one that you actually see. So I haven't really thought about that as a huge impact crater, but of course it is.
Yeah, and the rays you see, that's part of the ejecta material. Mm-hmm. So since it's so young,
right?
it's still preserved. Uh-huh. So it's like when the impact takes place, there will be a lot of material ejected up from the ground, and you will see it as these rays, basically. And they haven't disappeared because it's so young.
Yeah, and also, I guess we don't have a lot of like wind and stuff on the moon that could sort of erase it.
Exactly. But yeah, so that's why we have so many, we can see so many craters on other planets because they don't have plate tectonics, at least not as far as we know, but not as active on as on Earth, of course. And also we have weather on Earth and the large oceans, everything is there to just destroy.
So would you say that Earth is a bit boring as an impact crater scientist?
I mean, I think Earth is amazing, but if you're interested in impact craters, maybe it's not the best place.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because you mentioned tectonics, and I think I read like a couple of weeks or months ago, perhaps, that maybe Venus have tectonics. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm not updated on that, but I know, of course, that they are discussing it. Mm-hmm. But then the question is, like, if it had plate tectonics at some point, but either way, it is not as active as on Earth.
Right. Right. Do you have a favorite planet? Or is it the moon? You seem very...
I mean, I like the moon. Yeah. Because it's the one you see.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I also love Earth. I don't know. Maybe I should have like a great answer. I go by the looks, I think. Like, no, but like, I think Saturn is pretty. Yeah, so then I like that one.
I think that's also sort of spoken as a true geologist. So
maybe. Do you have a favorite planet?
I guess it's Jupiter, but it's the first one I saw through a telescope. So it was really like a big experience for me, like actually seeing one of the telescopes.
I think I saw that. I took an astronomy course at this department a couple of years ago, and we were able to visit the telescope that you have on the roof. And we actually got to see Jupiter. Yeah, that was amazing because you see it in pictures in books.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, of course it exists. But
yeah,
it's not until you actually see it that you're like, wow, it actually exists.
Yeah, you can see the storms that it has and the colors. And it's like, yeah, that was a great experience. Well,
yeah, I think everyone should see that at some point.
So actually we have Culture Night happening this weekend. And usually we have stargazing taking place, but because of the pandemic, that's not happening. But I still encourage anyone who has, you know, just a pair of binoculars or anything to go out and, yeah, look at the moon and perhaps look at the Tycho crater and just enjoy space.
So when does the moon rise tonight?
So it's fairly late. You have to stay up until like 2-3 o'clock in the night. But, you know, if you're a night owl, you can do it.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it, of course. And with that, I'd like to wrap up and thank you so much, Josephine, for coming to this podcast. It's been quite a pleasure to speak with you about your research.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Looking through our telescopes, we observe and study the universe we live in. We see planetary nebula, globular clusters, star-forming regions, and much, much more. Today we would like to spend a few minutes taking a closer look at one of the many wonders of the universe. Here to assist us, we have Katrin Ross, editor and magazine of Popular Astronomy. Welcome, Katrin.
Thank you, Nick.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. So tell us, what's captured your interest today?
Today I thought we could talk about the planet, which name is, as you said in the beginning, Nick, Dimidium.
Oh, yes. And there's another name for it, too, I think.
Yeah, so most people have probably heard of it as 51 Peg B.
Yeah, yes, I've heard of it quite a lot recently from my own research as well. So why is it so interesting?
So, well, it is a very interesting planet. And this week, it is 26 years ago since it was discovered. And that makes it the very first exoplanet or extrasolar planet that was discovered around a sun-like star.
Wow. Yeah. I know, it's kind of weird to think how far we've come since then. It's kind of a weird planet too, because it's a hot Jupiter, right?
Yeah, exactly. So even though it's like an around the sun-like star, it's very different from the actual planets in our solar system. So it's a hot Jupiter, which means that it's, well, it's really hot.
Yeah.
So it's actually around 1,284 Kelvin surface temperature. And that's really hot. That's sort of like lava on Earth. So throw a rock in there and it will melt.
Yeah, so we won't be pitching a tent there anytime soon.
Not exactly. I don't think that's the plan we would go to if we want to live somewhere, no.
Okay. Do you know why that was the first planet we detected? Nikki, if you have any kind of idea or...
No. Okay. Do you know?
Well, I think, I guess, with a lot of things when it comes to exoplanet research is the bias that we have with our detection. So we used... what's known as the radial velocity method to detect this planet, which basically is we detect the strength of the pull of the planet on its host star, and that actually sends a wobble in the star's signal that we can detect and show that there's a planet there. The thing is that, well, those signals are really exaggerated with really large planets which are really close to their star. And so basically the reason why we detected this one first, well, you know, among others, is that it was the easiest to detect. It created the strongest signal. And so, but also it's a lot weirder than any kind of thing that we know today. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting when we sort of look at those kinds of planets and sort of, it was almost like it was definitely going to be the first type that we were going to see. But at the same time, yeah, you want to find the next Earth, really. And then we see this crazy looking planet that we've never seen before. And it kind of shatters our reality on the science that we have. But are there any other cool like facts that you know about the planet that you've...
So just as you're saying, it's important that it's very close to its host star.
Yeah.
And that's why we could discover it so early. Mm-hmm. And it's actually so close that its orbit is just 4 days.
Yeah, yeah.
And to compare that to something, we have our closest in planet Mercury.
Yep.
But that has an orbit of 88 days. So like this... This 51 right. Peg B is a lot closer into its star.
Mm, so, yeah, it'd be a lot, quite a lot different to anything we've kind of
looked
at. So then how does it relate to Jupiter then, if we call it a hot Jupiter?
Yeah, hot Jupiter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's called Jupiter because it's basically the same size or half the mass of Jupiter.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But since it's so close into its star... we think that its radius is a lot bigger because it's sort of puffed up because it's so hot.
Right. Okay. And so that's how we kind of get that. Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah.
How do you like feel when it comes to like these, like does these kind of discoveries excite you personally when you come like, oh, look, you see it, you know, an exoplanet out there, a hot Jupiter, or, you know, what do you think when these kinds of things happen?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's super cool. I mean, I sort of remember before we didn't know any exoplanets and we didn't know if there was any exoplanets out there. So, I mean, this planet in particular is really, really cool and special, I think. It's really like marks the start of the era of exoplanets as we know them.
Yeah, it's kind of like really special to me because I was 1 year old when this thing was detected. So, you know, like I remember like as a 6 year old looking at science programs talking about like, oh, there are planets around other stars and like, you know, being inspired to thinking maybe that I can do that kind of research. And then, you know, now I'm living my 6 year old's dream and actually studying these planets a little bit more. And I feel like it's really cool to, a really cool aspect of this field is that it's so young.
Really right.
Like Rebecca studies stars, which is a very, you know, old pursuit. It's been around for 100 years. No offense, Rebecca. The science we're doing with stars is really cool because we've developed these techniques that, you know, we can really understand stars right now.
Mm.
But planets is something that we're still learning to do. It's only as old as I am, and I still don't really know what's going on in my life. So, you know, like that's the, that's kind of like, you know, I'm still figuring things out and we're still figuring things out too. One thing I really think is cool about 51 Pegasi B is that it has an atmosphere and we know that it has an atmosphere. So my research with my supervisor, Jens Hoijmakers, basically we look at these hot Jupiters, and because they're so close to their stars, light travels through their atmospheres quite a lot, and it actually gives us a good chance of detecting molecules such as carbon monoxide or water, which actually have been proved to exist.
Yeah.
So Ultra hot Jupiters, I think one of the, well, what I really love about them is that they're almost like laboratories for us because we can see the light coming through, and they sort of test, we can test our own theories and our own understanding of the planets that exist around it. But yeah, how far away is it though? Do you know that? I have no idea.
So it's about 50 light years away from us.
50 light years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, is that a long distance or a short distance?
Yeah, distances are weird in astronomy, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
It's not the closest planet we have around us. It's not the closest star. The closest star is around 3-4 light years away from us.
Okay.
So about 10 times as far away from as that.
10 times as far. Yeah.
But it's still sort of close. I mean, that's also why we could discover it.
Yeah, so like I guess, you know, if we talk about, some people think that like 1,000 light years is still, we call that the solar neighborhood or around that kind of
exactly.
That range. So it's quite close.
Yeah.
Still, we can't really send a rocket there though, or a satellite to observe it because, you know, it wouldn't get there. Well, we'd have to, you know, let our grandchildren take up the mission if we wanted to, but, and you know, it might get lost on the way there, but it's kind of cool, I think. And like, you know, maybe one day we might find a target that would be worth visiting, and then we have to start thinking about how we could possibly get there as well.
Yeah, that would be awesome, definitely.
Well, I think we might wrap up this conversation. So thanks, Katrin, for this week.
Thank you, Nick.
It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Cool.
The second episode of our first season of The Meridian was hosted by me, Rebecca Forsberg, and Nicolas Borsato. Our guests today were Josephine Martel and Katrin Roos, and our producer was Anna Arnadottir. If you have any comments or questions about the show, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observatory account on Twitter. In our theme at the beginning of the show, we could hear members of the 2021 Astronomical Youth Research School, which was held here in Lund back in July. The music we have heard is called Twilight and was composed by Stellar Drone. You can find all of our episodes on www.astro.lu.sg/themeridian. And make sure you tune into next week's episode when we'll be visited by Jens Hoymaches, who is an associate senior lecturer here at Lund Observatory working on exoplanets. Thank you for listening.